You're listening to Triple M, and we are going to introduce two guys that are a part of a band that have been voted number one, the Australian greatest of all time, the GOAT. It's In Excess. It's Tim and Kirk from the band. How are you? And welcome to Triple M.
Excellent. Now, that made my day, my year, my week.
Oh, awesome.
It's good to see the Triple M listeners have got great taste.
Yeah. Well, mate, we're sort of family with you guys. We've kind of almost been around the same amount of time as In Excess.
Exactly.
So it's like we're family. So how does it feel to be the GOAT?
Oh, look, it's an incredible honour. I mean, just the fact that our music's still played on radio stations around the world today is astounding. You know, I don't think any of us thought way back then when we were recording them that we would be doing this, you know, 30, 40 years down the track. So, look, we are absolutely honoured. And as I said before, the Triple M listeners have great taste in music and we thank them. Thank them for voting. It's great.
It's like, but there's new generations still discovering your music. So how does that make you feel? That, you know, you've got the young teenagers now that are now discovering In Excess.
I think it's great. I also think it's a testament to the songwriting and the fact probably that we never tried to just become one type of thing. We never just played the same sort of music over and over. We kind of morphed and changed and. And
we weren't interested. We weren't influenced by, you know, the fads that were going on either, were we? You know, we just kind of took our own course.
No, that's right. Exactly. We always tried to please each other and our own musical tastes first, and no matter what we did. And I think that translates now to the young listeners. You know, it was funny last night. My son, who's obviously been around ever since he was born,
that's amazing.
Yeah, in my life. He said to me last night, "Dad, listen to this." And I walked up to his car and he had Mediate playing in his car stereo. And I said, and he goes, "This sounds amazing." And I put my head in his ute and it really did sound amazing.
Yeah, right.
And you know, there was other things happening on it that he would switch between. And when I listened to it, funnily enough, it sounded like better than anything else that he was playing on his stereo. And I was just like, I was kind of like gobsmacked. I was like, wow, that really does sound good.
Because the production in your music is all, I mean, it still stands up today. So you put a lot of work into the production, into the sound, into the recording. Yes, was that important going in?
Oh, yeah.
Very much.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we always, in everything we did, from video making to our live performances to the studio, we looked for the best and cutting edge people we could, or more so that we could afford, especially when it came to live and things like that. But, you know, producer wise, it was really important to us who we picked, and we wanted generally more older school style, real producers, you know, that their intent was to get the best out of you and to record things faithfully and truthfully. And all our producers that we had over the years, their main, you know, apparatus sort of whatever you call it, their main objective was to try and capture what we were like live, because live we had a very powerful sound, you know, because that's where we formed our sound on stage. And so I think in essence, you know, what we ended up with was songs that were recorded as if we were, we were performing them live, but, you know, as if they've been performed in a live situation, just microphones and real instruments and real musicians, you know.
What was the process of recording? Was you went away and wrote the lyrics, or would you go into a studio and play some music? And then what was the process of constructing songs?
Well, we always used to rehearse before. When we had the time and could afford to, that was. Otherwise, with the first album, we would be playing gigs and then going into the studio after a gig, you know.
Yep.
And
road testing the songs on the door.
But we tried so many different things. Yeah, Michael sometimes was still writing lyrics when we were mixing.
Yeah.
You know, and so therefore the vocals weren't even finished as the various songs were being mixed. So whatever was clever for Trevor at the time, and like we tried our hands at everything, really. I mean, the best thing of all was when we fully realised that Andrew and Michael should take a stab at writing the whole record together. That sort of came about with Kick after Listen Like Thieves, and that proved to be a really a really good and positive step forward, I think.
One of the things we did with a lot of the albums too was we'd record half the album and then take a break for maybe 2-3 even sometimes 4 weeks. And Andrew and Michael would then go away knowing what sort of songs we needed as far as to try and, you know, because back then it was all about the album. It was all about, you know, whatever it was, 10 songs in the running order. And it was all meant to flow like almost like a live performance set. So Michael and Andrew would have the time to go away and write the rest of the album, you know, to sort of fill in the gaps in what we'd already recorded.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
For me, actually, my favourite albums we did were in the 90s.
I love those albums too.
Yeah, you know, and it's obviously everyone focuses on sort of kick and I think in Australia, especially The Swing. The Swing was a really huge album here in Australia, our fourth album. But everyone kind of tends to focus on kick. But, you know, for me, I actually prefer the X album. And, you know, my all-time favourite album of ours is Welcome to Wherever You Are.
Great.
Yeah, mine.
Is that right? Your both favourite album? Yeah. What would
But, well, having said that, I think that the albums that we did with Chris Thomas, from an arrangement and song point of view, superior. Having said that again, I think nothing I've ever heard of us sounds quite as sonically good as Kick. Just the whole process we went through of making that and getting Bob Clearmountain to master it and whatnot, that did turn out like a stunning record. There's no doubt about it. All the stars and planets lined up for that one.
Yeah. What would Michael think of being voted the Aussie GOAT, the greatest of all time?
He'd probably go, oh, again?
You got too fucking right, mate.
he would have loved it. I mean, you know, it's special when it's sort of people, fans, music lovers or listeners voting. That's super special because that's the real deal, you know, as opposed to sort of, you know, your peers maybe and all that sort of thing.
Mm. Well, that means a lot too, though.
Yeah, it does. I think
I wasn't contradicting you, Kirk. I was just saying that the peers thing, you know, like just lately, it, you know, that period through the 80s was so alive in Australia and Sydney and Melbourne in particular. You know, there was just so many bands playing on every pub and every corner. And, you know, from the time we became in excess after being the Farris Brothers, we were working 7 nights a week, you know, and
never played the same place. Played the same place, you know, in a 4 week period because there's so many gigs.
Crazy, and there were so many bands doing that.
Yeah,
and it didn't happen anywhere else in the world either. It was really unique to specifically Melbourne and Sydney, but also Adelaide and Brisbane. It was every pub had bands almost every night. You know,
it was amazing, and to think that out of all of that. We were the ones that really did the massive thing internationally. Mm. I think just goes to show how hard we worked.
Yeah,
and you know, so then when we talk about our peers, you know, I hope a lot of them realize that we weren't just lucky. You know, it was hard work.
Was there camaraderie amongst other bands?
Yeah, it was exciting. It was fun.
It was also, you know, it was also competitive though. Mm. But we had a lot of friends. There was a lot of bands that we did joint gigs together, or we stayed in the same hotel together at the same time, and that sort of thing. And you know, there was sort of mateship and all that, but not a lot of them are on the Christmas card list.
Yeah. Well, one in particular. But funnily enough, Mental as Anything used to call us the Sexies.
That's right. That right? Yeah.
They were good mates. They were good mates.
They were great mates.
Yeah. Hey, we're going to do a countdown now, the top 10 countdown of In Excess songs. Our listeners, our music jurors and our club members have voted their favourite In Excess song. Any guesses as to what that might be, the greatest song of all time from our audience?
Well, I don't know what...
Don't Change, maybe?
It's in the conversation, but it's not the number one.
Funnily enough, I only because I know it was probably our biggest selling single, and that was probably Good Times.
Oh, well, that's coming up, but that's not number one. We'll get there in just a moment. But we're going to start with Original Sin. So this was produced by the legendary Nile Rodgers. How did you come to work with Nile? What was the process of getting him on board?
Look, we were big fans. We were touring America, and on the bus, Tim brought Nile Rodgers' solo album, In the Land of the Good Groove. And we used to listen to it all the time because we just loved his guitar style, and it was just such cool music at the time. So we were big fans. And then, of course, he went and produced, a bunch of people, but David Bowie probably most notably with Let's Dance. And we thought, we've got to get this guy. And anyway, he happened to turn up at a gig in Toronto that we were doing, and he came backstage, and Tim couldn't speak because he was like sort of Tim's idol. He played Tim's favorite guitar brand, Tokai, and all that, right, Tim?
Yeah, well, he set me up with Tokai.
Did he? Yeah, right.
Noel set me up with Tokai, but Michael came over to me, and we were playing a stadium, Maple Leaf Gardens, and in Toronto, and Michael came over to me. I was chatting some chick up. And Michael came over to me and said, mate, there's someone over here I think you really want to meet. And it was Nile. Yep. And it was Nile Rodgers. So I was like, I couldn't believe it because, I mean, I was the one that was always playing his solo record on the bus and kind of going on about, how much work he'd done on records that we all love, like Diana Ross's Upside Down. Mm. And the Michael Jackson stuff, and suddenly I realized just how much Nile Rodgers was influencing modern music, Madonna stuff, like A Virgin and all that. And it just that's the thing about Nile is it's his style and technique is so subtle, yet it's so powerful and instrumental, and it's an amazing sound. So to meet the guy was just amazing, and he was like, yo man, we got to get into the studio when you guys are coming through New York. And we were like, we'll make that happen. So we did, and
we'll go there special.
Duran jumped on the same fucking bus.
Is that right?
Yeah, and you know what? Look, the recording session was really amazing because he was so relaxed. And like the first port of call was, we're going to send out for ribs, and he sent out for like buckets of ribs, and we had to eat ribs before we went in and recorded, But anyway, he was the first international producer we ever worked with, as it turned out, and just ironic that we were, huge respect and huge fans, and we had so much fun in the studio, but. More importantly, we then went to the UK to record the rest of the album with Nick Launay. And it was really weird for him because we'd recorded this song with Nile Rodgers, and then
it sounded amazing.
Yeah, how do you make the rest of the album with another producer sort of fit in with Original Sin and all that sort of stuff? So it was very an interesting kind of time. But as it turned out, it was our first number one in Australia. Argentina, number one in a lot of countries, but ironically, it was not well received in the US.
Isn't that crazy? Mm. Yeah.
That was a racial thing, though.
We're also going to play, you mentioned before, Good Time. So you hooked up with Jimmy Barnes, and is this another sort of one of those sort of last minute kind of recordings that you dropped?
Kind
of. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of. We're about to embark on the Australia Made Tour, which was a bunch of, the top Aussie bands doing a tour all together around the country. A lot of fun, as it turned out. But someone suggested that we needed, like, maybe some kind of song on the radio to sort of champion the tour. And so we got together with Barnsley in the studio, having any idea what we were going to do. And we had 2 days to record two songs, like a B-side and an A-side, and a video. And we did. We all decided we'll do an Easy Beats cover. And so we picked Good Times. And then we wrote a song called Laying Down the Law, which I think both of them ended up in was it Lost Boys?
Yeah, the Joel Schumacher movie.
The Joel Schumacher video.
Yeah.
The movie, I mean.
Joel.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
And Joel went on to do the Devil Inside video.
That's correct.
Yeah, right.
But so we did that, and the irony, I guess, in some ways too, was about a year after Michael passed away, we were still kind of trying to trying to work out if we wanted to continue or if we should continue as a band and all that sort of stuff. And we were in a studio looking at some of our old, you know, songs that never made it on records to see if any of them were worth fixing. And Barnsey calls up and said, you know, doing this big gig in Melbourne for a 25th anniversary of Mushroom Records, which is a really fantastic Australian, you know, music record label. And Good Times have been released on it. And he said, I want you to come and play, you know, Good Times with us live at this big, you know, stadium concert celebration in Melbourne. And we kind of like, and we did it. And we got, you know, an amazing reaction. And it really was probably what kickstarted and encouraged us to continue on as a band for the next 20 years, you know, after Michael died. And you know, in saying that, I mean, we've done some really amazing stuff since in the last 20 years as well. Stuff I'm certainly proud of. And it was pretty much Jimmy and that song that got the ball rolling.
Wow, it's amazing. We're going to play Don't Change as well. And for me, as a radio announcer, this is the one you throw the headphones off and you turn the studio monitors up. This is such a great song that, in fact, the National Film and Sound Archive have put it in their collection to be preserved. Don't Change. Yeah, Don't Change. And I also remember seeing The Killers a couple of years ago do an incredible cover of that song as well. So it's well regarded. Tell us about the memories of Don't Change and recording that.
Well, funny enough, that was one song that we really did write all together. We all came up with different parts. I remember my part.
It was the last song we all wrote together, I think, really, before everyone started writing.
It was properly constructed by us all together in rehearsal. You know, we actually sort of did write it together, you know, and it was... So it was always really popular with all of us. and it was always the last song of the night, except Wembley Stadium. I think that's the one and only time we didn't finish with Don't Change.
Yeah, it was one of those songs there was nowhere else to put it in the set because no song sort of kind of worked after it because it was such a powerful sort of anthemic song. So that's why it ended up being, you know, the last song in the last encore every night. So it's probably the most played or most performed live song of all our songs. You know, it was in every set every night. You know,
and the oldest.
Yeah. All right, we're working our way. We're down to number two here in our countdown, the greatest of all time, voted by our Triple M listeners. And at number two is "Need You Tonight," which reached number one globally. So number one in the US and the UK as well. What happens when you reach number one in the US? Do you get a phone call from the record company, or do you remember when that went?
We got a crate of French champagne. literally. That was a really great thing to achieve. It really was. You know, up until then, I'd been pretty happy with being number five on the top 40 in the US with What You Need. But you know, having broken that number one spot, you're just gobsmacked because it's just so hard to believe that, you know, little old us had made it that big. You know, that we were the most loved song of the time, whatever the period it was, in somewhere like the United States of America, which is so fucking big, it's ridiculous. You know, we spent so much time touring there that we. You know, it's crazy. I think my brother Andrew figured out that we'd spent something like in consecutive nights on a bus. I don't know, something ridiculous.
Like a thousand or something.
Yeah, it was crazy. And yet we still hadn't seen all of it, you know. But there was always somewhere different to play in America and a new city and you know.
And the world too, yeah.
And the world, for that matter. So, you know, it was certainly a big achievement and something now to look back on, something I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
Was there I think you're on. For me with Needs United, it was not so much that it went to number one in America. It was the fact that we knocked Michael Jackson off the number one spot.
Yeah,
that meant a lot more. Yeah. That meant a lot more to me.
Was there a sense of patriotism, you know, when you were touring overseas? You sort of felt like, you know, we're Aussie guys, we're, you know, representing Australia?
Yeah. Absolutely. Particularly in the US. And people were always reminding us that we were Australian, you know. So in some ways we talk with a stronger Australian accent when we're overseas than we do when we're at home. Because it's an identity, you know, and one that we're proud of. Mm. So we did wave the flag a lot overseas, and we were proud to be Australian.
We're talking to Tim and Kirk.
Cultural as well.
Yeah, of course. Talking to Tim and Kirk from INXS here. So we're at the number one spot. So this one has been voted the greatest of all time from our listeners. It's the wow. Aussie GOAT, and it is Never Tear Us Apart is the wow. number one huh. song. What are your memories of this song? What do you recollect about Never Tear Us Apart?
You got to love a good ballad, don't you, eh?
Yes. Yeah. For me, making the video, funnily yeah. enough. In the studio, it was just another song, you know. I mean, I thought it was great and I loved the lyrics. But for me, the strongest memories were travelling to Prague and Czechoslovakia when we did, because it was Czechoslovakia then, now it's mm. Czech Republic. And, you know, it was behind the Iron Curtain. And it was literally everything there was grey and dull and black and white, architecturally beautiful. And an amazing city, it still is. But it was, you know, the food was really ordinary. Our hotel rooms were like, gag me with a spoon. You know,
that's what's the food.
The black and white television with one dude talking on it 24 hours, and that was it, one station. You know? And it was probably what you were supposed to order, you know, this is my dual door kind of thing. And it was just, it was really awful that people had to live like that. Mm. But we had, you know, and it was cold as too when we were making the videos. But it was so out of place and so such an unusual journey for us, yeah, that it was great. It was really, it was awesome, especially looking back at it now.
Mm. Richard Lowenstein, he produced that video, didn't he? Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
So well thought. Yeah.
Yeah, it was his idea just because, you know, he really felt the emotive value of the song, and he had been to Prague years before, and it's one of the only, you know, major cities in Europe that didn't get bombed in World War II. So it's still, you know, as it was in most of the old town parts, as it was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And it is just beautiful, you know.
We've been back a few times.
Yeah, we have actually. We've been back there to play, and it's so different now. I'm really glad that we got to go there when, you know, when it was still in the old world, shall we say.
And of course, Kirk, the saxophone solo in this song, it's still one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, look, it's funny because Chris Thomas, who produced, you know, Kick, he got me to play that saxo like 100 times in a row. And to me, it was the same every time. And I got really frustrated and I got really angry and started swearing at him, you know, I'm playing it the same every time. What is it? He said, do it again. And so it was that take. He said, yep, got it. He just waited till I was angry and all that.
Just pushing your buttons.
And I think, you know, he must have heard something different in the way I played them, but I sure didn't. But anyway, once I got to that point of anger and kind of yelling at him, he said, got it.
No, oh, that's amazing. Well, we're so
he just didn't want to do the bass.
Yeah, he wants to do bass.
Well, as I mentioned, it's an incredible song, and thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been an absolute thrill to talk to you about some of the memories and the records, and so what's next for you guys? What are you working on? Is there anything in the future that you got your fingers in pies?
Not really.
Well, we can't really talk about it at the moment because they're under confidentiality agreements.
All right, stay tuned.
But stay tuned. There's things bubbling.
There's always something happening.
Oh, yeah.
There's always something happening. I mean, look, we're all enjoying life now as well. That we're able to have one. As glamorous as it all seems, we were so freaking busy during the highlight of our career and then some. We didn't know how to stop. We couldn't stop being in excess. And I think we've finally been able to take a step back, look at our career and really decide what's the best thing for it.
Yeah. But also be immensely proud of what we did create and our legacy, Michael's legacy. It's dreamlike.
Yeah.
You know, it's It's amazing.
Well, it's well deserved. The greatest, Aussie greatest of all time, in excess, here on Triple M. Tim and Kirk, thanks so much for the chat. Really appreciate it.
And we're very humbly accept the GOAT. Yes.
Thanks, Triple M listeners.
Good on you.
Hi, I'm Tim Farris.
And I'm Kirk Pengilly, and we're from In Excess.
And thank you, Triple M listeners, for voting us the GOAT.